magnetometer from Dave Witten yesterday, and today I was trying to set it up and I was having trouble, and I said, well, this worked before, having trouble, but it was discovering things, but it was not collecting data. And I fiddled with it, and at the end I had my old small board magnetometer. So I pulled out the PNI board and put it in the new board, and it worked. So I have a failed PNI board. Well, not failed, half failed. It communicates its protocols, but it does not collect data. So I assume it's a solder or something. If anybody's got an idea what we can do with it, we'll talk about that later. Okay, next on the list, we have Nathaniel, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Thank you, Dave. It's been a busy week here. We've wrapped up classes at the University of Scranton. My students are busy working on their DSP final exam right now. I gave a technical talk and a keynote at the Radio Club of America symposium on Saturday. We've been advising a number of people in the ham sci community for doing posters for the American Geophysical Union meeting, including Dev, who we'll talk about his later, and Steve Serwin's doing one at the Doppler Shift. Christina Collins is doing one for Case Western in the Eclipse. We have another one with Asti Bhatt at SRI in California, looking at traveling ionospheric disturbances. And there's another one that somebody else is doing too. So we have, and I'm also working on. So it's been a very, very busy week, and it's not slowing down. So we're working on it. Back to
very, very good. Next on the list is Dave Witten, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello, all. I've had a busy day and been fairly busy for most of the last week, especially today. We got the production magnetometer, or at least the production test magnetometers, in the mail late Saturday sometime, and got a pair today, and I've been working on, you know, making proper housings for them and getting holes and such in my yard and buying dirt to pile up around them and so forth. But today I kind of overslept and woke up to quite a lot of activity by Dave Larson here and and also Jules both with questions and issues, and mostly about software, which I was really, and also, of course, today's the day that old clients decided to call me up with immediate, you know, urgent problems that needed my attention. But anyway, in the meantime, I kind of managed to get things set up in a more appropriate testing configuration for these things, and believe I'm pretty much there now. Things are running, and we're working to get a more. I'll be working in the next few days to clean up the output that goes to the logs, and I need to get the metadata information from John, because I don't really know what needs to go in there, and also make sure that the formatting is consumable by all. The number two job that I plan to knock out is an rsync, some sort of a script and whatever it takes to get an rsync task on one's magnetometer, on one's Raspberry Pi or whatever, that will upload log files a couple times a day to the Linode instance that Nathaniel provided, and that way we'll have a place to put log files and need to make new instructions and simplify some of the software so it's easier to, more straightforward to use. And I don't know what else, but those things over the next few days probably be trying to knock out as many of those things. There's doubtless some potholes in the road that'll need to be fixed along the way, but that's what's occupying me at the moment. Over to y'all.
Next on the list, we have Dev. Go ahead, Dev.
It's me.
Yes.
Thank you so much. So as Nathaniel said, it's been a busy week. We have been working, I think, many in the PSWS, Personal Space Weather Station project. Many teams are working towards a poster. I finished mine. I have already, what they call as, published in AGU. And if time permitting, I would like to show a video when the general discussion opens. I think which I have sent a link in the Tangerine list email as well. So I think we're slowly making progress, and I'm occupied with a bug in running the FARLAP ray tracing package in MATLAB for the Linux Ubuntu 18.04 machine that I have now. So I could not fix the bug. So if time allows, I would like to discuss those two points.
Okay. Very good. Well, next on the list is John Ackerman. Go ahead, John.
Hello, folks. I thought it was about time to give an update on how the clock module design is going after a lot of work that's been going on for the last several months. So whatever's the appropriate time, I've got a little presentation with kind of the where we are and also some preliminary data from some breadboard testing we've been able to do.
Well, the pattern is a la the old TeamSpeak OpenHPSDR. We do a roll call and then open for general things. So we'll come back to you once we finish the roll call. We have a lot of people tonight. Next on the list is Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill.
Thanks, Dave. Good evening to the net, and been fairly busy here. I worked on getting the fire hose local system working, where you basically you give the data engine an IP address and a port, and then put it into fire hose local mode. And when you tell it to start collecting data, it just starts a raw feed of everything it collects on that channel and sends it to that IP and that port. And so I've been able to simulate that situation of that with a virtual machine and get the data engine just send everything it collects directly to a fast server on the local area network. So that is working. And I wrote up, well, I added a little bit to the specification. I realized on the spec, the data engine to local host specification for that protocol, I realized I had a way to put it into fire hose mode, but not to take it out of fire hose mode. So I added an additional thing to take it out of fire hose mode and also to turn LEDs off. I had something to turn an LED on, but not to turn them off. So that was what you got today in the Tangerine data feed, was an updated specification on that. Nathaniel, you should have received the NASA pre-proposal with Dr. Atkinson's inputs all included into it. So let me know what further you need on that. The other thing is I finally got my contest station working properly, worked ARRL sweeps this weekend, and I took the advice of some people. Just if you have a good station, just park on a frequency and call CQ. And I worked 1,120 QSOs and worked 82 of the 84 ARRL sections in North America and over the course of, let me see, it was a 30-hour contest, and I was on for, I think, 22 hours. And Prince Edward Island and Newfoundland, best I could tell, they only worked a few contacts for a few lucky people, and I was not one of them. So, but what are you going to do? I've only worked a sweep one time, and that was in 2014. So we came this close to it this year, but got to keep trying every year. maybe we're, next year we'll work unlimited and use spotting networks. And maybe I just worked Class Bravo this year, so didn't use the spotting networks, but maybe next year we'll try that and see what happens. Okay, back to Ned.
Very good. And let's see, next on the list is Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Thank you, Dave, and good evening, everyone. Well, I'm sorry I missed last week. I will spare everyone the details other than to say the stitches came out on Wednesday of last week, and before that I was not feeling all that great. So anyway, I did have a couple of comments. I'd listened to the recording from last week, and I saw something on the Explaining Computers presentation that Chris Barnett did this last week about thermal. Well, it was actually about power consumption on the Raspberry Pi 4. And he has a little stress test that he uses to exercise all four cores to max out the temperature on the Raspberry Pi 4. And he actually ran that. And at idle, it was 2 watts. Running the stress test, it was 4 watts of power consumption. So I don't think we're going to have a big problem with heat in the Raspberry Pi. It's going to have some sort of airflow, but I don't think it's going to have to be substantial. So anyway, I know there was some concern about that. And I think if you're interested, you know, go back and look at Chris's YouTube video from this last week, and you'll get a pretty good appreciation for what sort of power consumption single board computers have. Other than that, I worked a little bit on a 3D model for the Raspberry Pi 4 plus a Pi hat. I have something that I think will work. I don't have a hat right now, so I can't really check it, but I do have something in the works. So we'll have a starting point at least and see where we can go from there. Anyway, back to you, Dave.
Very good. And let's see, next on the list, we have David Lewis. Go ahead, David.
Can we get back on? Good evening.
Yep.
Well, Dave Lewis, W2HMT. Just interested in what all of you gentlemen and others are doing, especially in the magnetometer area. I thought my friend Jules might be on tonight, but I don't see him yet. But anyway, back to Nat.
He was here last week. So last week we got him, and this week we get you. Welcome.
You got the better deal last week.
Yeah. Okay. Next on the list, we have David McGaw in 1HAC. Go ahead.
Hello, everyone. Received the new magnetometer boards today. So I'm looking forward to powering those up and getting new software for them and all of that. And as I pinged John earlier today, I'm very interested in seeing the current state of the clock board and maybe being able to assist with it at some point. I consider that a very important component to the system so that we can be running these devices well synchronized and do some array work. So back to Nat.
Very good. Next on the list is Gary, AF8A. Go ahead, Gary.
Yeah, good evening, everyone. I understand we're busy, so I'll turn it right back to Ned. Thank you.
Very good. Next on the net list is James KG4DSG. Go ahead, James.
Evening, all. Just listening in, looking forward to the clock module discussion, and back to the net.
Very good. Next on the list, we have Jim, 7J1AJH. Welcome back.
Hi,
Jim.
Thank you. Good morning. Nothing. Just want to follow along. Thanks.
Very good. And then we have, let's see, I already called on John, John Ackerman. John N8OBJ. Go ahead.
Yes. John Gibbons, N8OBJ. Working on the low-cost space weather station among five other things I got going. First thing I wanted to show is this is my modified board I put in for, this is going to a ninth grade student in Fort Collins, Colorado, who is going to be our frequency reference measurement station for the Doppler shift data. I've got his FT817 modified to accept the Leo Bodnar GPSDO, so he has a decent clock so he can actually make the measurement. That's one project. The second thing that came along was Scotty's little board. And as you can see, this is the case that we use. Where's the camera there? That we use for mounting the thing on there. And when you plug the header on, I'm about 150 thousandths above the pins. And it also blocks the fan. So we're going to have to work on that. The other problem I'm having is putting it into the ground. I have a 1.5-inch PVC pipe. And yes, the connector for the RJ45 interferes with it going in.
Yep.
So if we rotate that 90 degrees in the center, that'll fix that problem. Although on the low-cost weather station, I am going to have this connector on there. So maybe it might not be necessary. Scotty, I'm going to have to talk about that. Because if this is the one that's going in the ground, it would be nice if we could rotate the RJ45 90 degrees, because then it'll fit very nicely in the 1.5 PVC pipe, and you can use a 2-inch drill to put it down below the frost line. And right, Cleveland here, that's 3 feet down. Let's see, I'm making 7 or 8 more of the low-cost weather stations to be shipped out to different places, including Nathaniel. Got that all going, got the software update coming. I'm working on the the header data for Dave Witten. I got the files from Bill Engelke for the C code, and I have to incorporate that to get that to work. Once I get that working, I get it to David and give him the Python script that generates the file structure for the entire weather station. And then the code that would be the boilerplate that I'm planning on using goes off, reads all that information, and creates a header file for every day's data file. So that's all in the works. Other than that, I'm not doing much of anything. Back to that.
Very good, John. Next on the list, we have Nathaniel.
I think I already went.
Oh, sorry, not Nathaniel. Jonathan. So Jonathan, KC3EEY, go ahead.
Hi, everybody. I do not have much to report. It is finals week here at the University of Stratton. I'm very busy at work. I'm very busy with finals and all the last work that has to be handed in. So I've been mainly doing that. But as soon as that's done, I could mess around a little bit more with the with my project. The application, the evaluation board came in for the 6140 ADD converter, and it looks like that the clock is generated from the Exmos USB audio controller. It also has an audio output. It has a D2A converter for an audio output as well, PCM9211. And I'm not really sure exactly why that they added that. I have to go through the manual. So, as far as plans, what I wanted to do was make this work not only as a Raspberry Pi sound card, but a sound card that's for the Tangerine SDR. So I will be using a separate crystal for the Raspberry Pi sound card and the programmable clock from the Tangerine SDR. So I'm interested to hear about the progress of the clock module. That's all I have for now. Back to the net.
Very good. Next on the list, we have Kevin B. Go ahead, Kevin.
Good evening, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Perfect. Brand new general operator just passed my test Saturday, and had local net on Sunday, and they mentioned this organization. So I'm just here to kind of see what it's all about.
Well, we're developing radios, and so building them from scratch. And so welcome, and hopefully you got some engineering skills, can help build things.
I will be starting electrical engineering degree in the summer.
Oh, very good. Okay, and next on the list, we have Michael, AAAK. Go ahead, Michael. Very good.
Nice.
Good. And next, we have Jules. Go ahead, Jules.
Hello, 1, 2, 3. I think I'm unmuted now.
Yes, you're unmuted.
Okay, great. Just got Scotty's. I just saw me a little late. I had to help my daughter with a fixture she's making for her piano technician work. Anyway, Scotty's boards arrived, and I just picked them out of the mail about 45 minutes ago. Haven't opened the box yet, but I'm looking forward to doing that. I have a dual mag embedded unit in service currently. I put it in over the weekend, down to a depth of 30 inches, and I'm working with Dave to just go over some software issues. But everything seems to be working properly, and looking forward to making those direct comparisons of the two units that are about 4 inches apart. Other than that, I'm hoping to use Scotty's boards and get another mag going by the end of the next weekend and try to get that in the ground as well. That's it from here.
Okay, very good. And let's see, Scotty is the next, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, Dave, thanks, and good evening, everyone. Sorry, Dave, you got a magnetometer that didn't work. I tested every one, but I did not stream data from everyone. I merely tested to see if they responded to addresses. So
it did respond to addresses.
Yep.
And it was boards 7 and 8.
Okay.
For your records.
But since you put your a new magnetometer in, it worked, right?
Yeah, when I took the magnetometer I already had in, which I've been running for 4 months now. So I knew it worked.
Well, check the headers and see if I messed up and didn't solder one of the pins. That might be one thing. Yeah. Other than that, if it's a bad one, we should swap it out with another one. Okay. I have a few spares that we bought. So,
okay.
And this week has been like happened to Dave Witten, a couple high priority previous contracts came out of the woodwork, which required some work. So it's just trying to get that out of the way so that we can clear the slate for the new stuff coming up, which is coming up pretty fast here. And I exchanged a few emails with Tom and John, Clock Module. So looking forward to seeing that presentation too. So we'll take any more time. Back to you, Dave.
Okay. And we're down to Tom. Tom?
Okay. Last and least this week. Extremely busy week. Unfortunately, none of it on the project. Learned how to bring up a Kubernetes cluster. Oh my goodness.
Oh, I had a little fun with those too. And the trouble is I learned a bunch of it, and then after not using it for a while, I forgot a bunch. So I have to relearn it. So anyway, I think the talk of the night that is top of the list is John's talk on the clock module. So we'll let John talk for a bit.
Okay, well, just to kick it off, we've been working on this for quite some time with the idea of building a more or less traditional GPSDO, GPS disciplined oscillator, but with a couple of tweaks that might have let us knock a little bit of cost out and simplify the design. But about, a month ago now, I had one of these brainstorms. And it's ended up with a 90 degree turn that's knocked a tremendous amount of cost and simplicity out of the design. And it's going to work. I've been able to breadboard it enough that I think we're very confident it'll function. So I'll talk a little bit about the general introduction to what we're trying to do, and then what this new possibility is and how we'll get there. And then I've got some performance data. You all know me, so you know that I will talk to fill the available time. So feel free to tell me to move along. Okay. or to spend more time on something and less time on something else. So I will share the screen if I can. And I think this should be the presentation. Are you seeing?
Yes.
Okay. So, and this started out as a presentation I gave at DCC. Actually, might have even been at DCC was the most recent. So these are the requirements that we had for the Tangerine SDR clock. Basically, we need the 122.88 meg clock to drive the RF modules. We also wanted pulse per second and timestamps to be able to do data tagging. Hopefully, a general purpose 10 meg reference signal. We'd like the GPS module to be able to also provide the raw data that's required to get total electron count measurements for space science experiments. And then specifications were challenging because I don't think anybody on the science side really knows the full scope of what we might want to do with this thing. So after a lot of conversation, I sort of pulled out of the air a set of specs that so far people seem to be happy with, and I hope that they are sufficient. The first is that the long-term frequency accuracy is within per trillion, 1 × 10⁻¹². That the stability, how much it wiggles around in the short term, is 1 part per billion or better. That the pulse per second timing accuracy is within 100 nanoseconds, and the jitter on that is less than 10 nanoseconds. And then finally, the phase noise, which is important for the RF application. We pulled out a couple of numbers for the different offsets from the carrier of -80 at 100 hertz and -150 at 100 kilohertz, which I'm hoping we'll be able to meet. Those are probably the most challenging specs in the design that we have in progress. So summarizing what we've already talked about, the basic idea behind a GPS disciplined oscillator is that the GPS signal coming out of the module has extremely good long-term accuracy and long-term frequency stability, but there's a lot of jitter on that the pulse per second that comes out, and you can't directly lock that to a crystal because it bounces around too much. So you use a phase lock loop and have a crystal oscillator that you can almost think of as a flywheel. That's the crystal oscillator is running at 10 megahertz, and it's an oven or temperature controlled, and its signal is divided down and compared to the pulse per second coming from the GPS, and you very slowly steer the crystal to keep it in sync. And the goal is that you want to get to match where the worsening performance of the crystal over time, because it drifts and wanders around, matches the improving performance of the GPS over time as the jitter becomes a smaller component, and design the thing so that you can meet that crossover point. And this plot shows kind of how that works. The green is a somewhat typical oscillator. It's in this case a temperature controlled crystal oscillator at 125 megahertz. And the violet trace is a really, really, really good modern GPS. The blue trace is a cheap, more traditional GPS. And you can see what happens where the Allen deviation crosses over. And again, to summarize, Allen deviation is kind of how much statistically we would expect the signal to wander around between subsequent measurements taken at the time interval shown on the x-axis. So what this is saying is that if we take a sample every second of the oscillator, we will statistically see that it's got noise on it of roughly 1 part in 10⁰ or 100 picoseconds from second to second measurements. And if we look out here at 100 seconds, now we have about 50 nanoseconds of jitter second to second. So that's kind of what this plot is showing. It's log scale with the stability on the y-axis and the measurement time on the x-axis. So what we want to do is have a phase lock loop that tries to hit these crossover points so that in the short term, we get the good performance of the crystal, and in the long term, we get the good performance of the GPS. That's the whole goal of the thing. So traditionally, you'd have a GPS that's got a pulse per second coming out, and then your 10 megahertz, either temperature-controlled, crystal-controlled oscillator, divide that down to pulse per second, have a phase detector that looks at the difference between the two, and a feedback loop with a phase lock loop that will steer the crystal so that its pulse per second stays locked to the GPS pulse with a very long time constant to get rid of the jitter. In a traditional GPS DO, the time constant might be anywhere from 100 to 1,000 seconds. So we're relying on the oscillator for that short term for several hundred seconds, and then gradually we transition to being controlled by the GPS signal. And then some added things that you'd like to have a holdover capability. So if the GPS goes away, you still have a usable signal coming out. And as a subpart of that, you'd like to learn about how the crystal is aging and how its temperature sensitivity works so that you can compensate for that when it's in free running mode. And finally, you might have a variable loop bandwidth so that it's faster to acquire. If you think about a loop that's got a 1,000-second time constant, it can take an awful long time for that to lock in. So you might have a fast loop at the beginning, and then once it acquires it, go to the slower loop. And so you end up with this kind of traditional architecture, GPS engine going into a time interval counter, and 10 megahertz divided by 10 to the seventh going into the time interval counter. You get a difference output that feeds into a microprocessor that steers a digital analog converter, which steers the crystal oscillator to keep everything so that this time interval remains constant over time. That's the traditional design that we were originally thinking of using for the clock module with a few tweaks. The question came up whether these new GPS modules that are out would let us do better. And my original thinking was, if there's less jitter on the GPS pulse per second, that means we can have a shorter loop time constant. That means that maybe we can have a shorter, we can use a cheaper crystal because it doesn't need to be stable for as long a time period. If we have a 10 second loop constant, the performance of the crystal beyond, you know, that 10 to 20 or 30 seconds doesn't really matter. So what I wanted to do was test some of these newer modules to see whether they would give us an improvement. And they do. This chart again is Allen deviation, and it's the raw pulse per second output of three GPS modules. The green is a uBlocks M9N, which is a cheap, it's about a $15 unit. The violet is the Neo MAT, which is a single frequency timing receiver. And it looks actually like it's worse than the Neo in this plot, but for practical purposes, they're really about identical. There's very little difference between the two. But the blue line is the dual frequency receiver that uBlocks recently released. And you can see it is substantially better. So I thought, aha, that is goodness. We can use the fancier receiver to get lower noise, have a faster loop constant, and we could have a cheaper crystal. So that was the original design idea. And this was the original design of the clock module, which has a big FPGA in the middle that does all the hard work. And it acts kind of like a switch bus. And we have a GPS signal, which doesn't actually show up on here for some reason in this plot. But over in this corner where there's blank space, there should be a box that says GPS, and it's sending its pulse per second out to the FPGA. We have a crystal oscillator over here that's generating a 10 megahertz output, and that goes into the FPGA where it's divided down to pulse per second. We have a phase detector, which is actually a chip that I used in the TIC time interval counter that's measuring the time difference between the two pulse per seconds and outputting a value that can be used by the control loop to steer them. And then FPGA then outputs to a DAC, which steers the crystal. And then we further lock that because that's 10 megahertz, but we need 122.88. So we now have a 122.88 megahertz crystal that we lock to the 10 megahertz, again, kind of going through the FPGA, a four-way buffer, and that gives us the outputs that the Tangerine needs. So that was the original design. It was cool. It was very flexible. It would allow us to do lots of other things, but still fairly complicated, and we would have to write all the code that sits inside the FPGA to be the control algorithm, and I wasn't really looking forward to doing that. So I then kind of put together a couple of the different measurements that I had done, and I went through all this in more detail at the DCC, and I've got other papers that I can point you to if you're interested in more background. But so taking the ZF9T, which is the best fancy new expensive GPS module, this is its raw pulse per second performance, which ain't bad. But the receiver can output what's called a quantization error message or Q error message that tells me that the next hardware pulse that comes out is going to be 4.2 nanoseconds slow against GPS. And I can then compensate for that in software. And this violet plot shows what happens when I do that. And you see things get a whole lot better. And this is what I was counting on to let me be able to use a cheap crystal, because I can do the error correction and get down here to very nice performance, about 5 and 10 to the 10th at 1 second with just the raw GPS by applying that software correction. So that's what all that design that I just showed you was based on, the idea. But as part of the testing that I did was these new GPS modules, they've got an output that's called time pulse. And traditionally we set that to one pulse per second. Well, these things can be set for up to 25 megahertz output. So I thought, what if I set the time pulse to 10 megahertz? And what kind of output would I get from that? And that's what happens, the green line, which is incredible. We're down at 1 second. It actually parts in 10 to the 11th in this measurement. This measurement was done separately, and it actually goes to the left-hand limit is 0.1 seconds. So 1 second here is where the other plots stop. But you can see in the short term, we're significantly better yet. And this is a raw output from the GPS. I don't need to process any data messages or anything. And this is easily good enough to meet the performance requirements that we have for the Tangerine. The problem is that the phase noise of this 10 megahertz signal coming out of the GPS is awful. This is a plot of phase noise with decibels down from the carrier on the left and the offset from the carrier on the right. And remembering that we want to be down in the minus 150 area, ideally, when we get out here, we're more like minus 100. It's just, and there's spurs, and it's ugly, because that 10 megahertz is being generated by some kind of a DDS or numerically controlled oscillator, and it's being jerked around by the updates from the GPS engine. So it's just, it's not very good. And the inset in the lower left is maybe more intuitive. This is a spectrum analyzer plot with the black line being the noise, the spectrum from the GPS, the green line being a pretty good quality signal generator. So you can see the noise sidebands that are here. So the bottom line is you cannot put that 10 megahertz signal on the air. The phase noise and spurs on it would just be horrible. So we can't directly use the 10 megs, but I had previously been, and for a different project, looking at a chip that Silicon Labs makes. It's called a jitter attenuator. And it's designed for telecom systems where you think about a cabinet where you've got a master clock signal that's going to drive a whole bunch of cards, and those cards are need to come up with different frequencies, and they also need to be very clean. And when you're distributing your master clock around the rack, it's going to pick up noise and stuff. Well, these chips are designed to provide that cleanup. And the block diagram on the right is, I probably don't need to go into all the details, but it has four clock inputs that you can set to any frequency that you want between 8 kilohertz and 750 megahertz, and a PLL system that can generate any output from 100 hertz to a little bit over 1 gigahertz. And the part that I've got shown in red here, there's a separate crystal oscillator up here that provides the signal source for this PLL. And the idea is that this crystal oscillator is very low noise, and it's driving the PLL, and it filters out all the crud that's on the inputs from coming from the master clock. So my thought was, geez, why don't we take that ugly 10 megs coming out of the GPS, shove it into here, and not only clean it up, but also convert it to whatever frequencies we want. We have four outputs, and we can program those to anything we want. So three of them can be 122.88 to drive Tom's RF modules, or alternatively, we can make four of them be each 1 kilohertz offset from a WWV frequency to drive the Grapes receiver, to provide clocking for that. All we need to do is program it. So in one chip, we basically have a complete disciplined oscillator with the equivalent of the GPS coming in over here, the equivalent of the 10 megahertz over here. It's actually 40 megs in this case, and then frequency translation to get whatever we want. So that means we can have a really simple system. The GPS module plus this chip is about $15 in quantity, and the crystal oscillator we're going to be using is about $17 in quantity. So, you know, we got add some other stuff, less than $50 in parts cost for the most basic system, which is way cheaper than the other design we were working on. The phase noise from this chip is very good. It's not quite as good as I would ideally like. That 150 dB down at 100 kilohertz, that was our goal. Here, we're actually more in the minus 140 range. So it's not quite what we want. And by the way, this plot is not something that's directly from my data. It's something from one of their app notes. And I'm showing it just to show kind of directionally what the phase noise looks like. But we think that this is still good enough for all of our RF applications to have the minus 140 to 100 kilohertz and down below 160 when you get out to a megahertz and beyond. So pretty good phase noise. Now, the local crystal, the 40 megahertz, can be either a bare crystal or a TCXO. And the evaluation board for this chip that I have has just the bare crystal. And if we look at the short-term stability of that, that's the blue line. Remember, my target is to always be 1 in 10 to the ninth part per billion or better. This doesn't quite make it. But there's a similar board, earlier generation chip, that does more or less the same thing. And that evaluation board comes with a TCXO on it. So with that board, even though it's not quite the same chip, I can see what the performance looks like in short term with the TCXO, and that's the violet line. Well, we're down here in the range of 3 and 10 to the 10th at 1 second, and then out here's where the GPS starts to take over. So look only at this before it starts sloping downhill. This is way better than the part per billion spec that we had. So with the TCXO, the short-term stability will do everything that we wanted. So this is the Mark II clock module. And it's also somewhat chopped off. I'm not very good at these graphics. Let me see if I escape out of here. I'm going to go elsewhere to show you this picture because this didn't come through the way we had hoped it would. Even this didn't come through. That's interesting. It chopped stuff off. So my apologies, but basically over here on the very right-hand end is the 72-pin connector that, yes.
You need, it's sharing, I'm getting your picture.
Okay. Okay, I've only got it sharing. Okay, never mind. Let me go back to the slideshow. Is it? Which is still showing as much. So you should see it now.
I'm seeing you.
It stopped sharing. I'm weird.
Yeah, sometimes weird. It does that. You have to stop it and start it manually.
Yeah. Okay.
There you are.
Okay. Okay. So this is the Mark II, and the bottom of it's chopped off. So I apologize for that. You're not missing too much. But over here on the far right-hand side is the 74-pin or 75-pin or 76-pin or whatever it is connector that Scotty is using to interface the module to the data engine. This is this Silicon Labs synthesizer chip, the 48 megahertz TCXO, the opportunity to plug in an external reference. So if somebody's already got a good GPSDO or a cesium clock or whatever, they can use that instead of the GPS. Then the GPS module, which is sending 10 megahertz into the synthesizer chip, one pulse per second out to the rest of the system, and also the GPS data out to the rest of the system on this connector. And that's the part that's chopped off, I'm sorry to say. But so this is basically the entire system with the two main modules, the GPS and the Silicon Labs chip, plus the TCXO. And the other thing that's really cool about this is there is no programming. Because the SI chip does everything. There's a software program that Silicon Labs makes available that you tell it what frequencies go in and what frequencies come out and what kind of bandwidth you want to use for the loop. And it generates the registers to program it. And then you upload the registers into the chip at boot time and it starts doing it. So our code development time drops to basically nil with this. So this is a really cool idea. And the question is, how well does it work in practice? Well, because I've got the GPS module and I've got the evaluation board, I was able to do a set of tests. And, let me back up one. We're thinking of having four different versions potentially of the board, a base version that has no GPS at all, so it requires the external frequency reference. This might be more interesting to the time nuts than to the space science group. A bronze version that uses a module, a GPS that's $14 in 100 unit quantity, so really, really cheap. The only problem with it is its RF performance isn't quite as good, as you'll see, but it does only has one pulse output, which means that if we use that pulse to generate the 10 megahertz, we don't get a pulse per second. So if you go with the bronze version, we won't get timing out of it, but we will still get pretty good frequency. Then the silver uses the older generation timing chip, a little bit better RF performance. It has the second output, so we get the pulse per second and the timing information. It's $52. And then finally, the dual frequency gives us the best RF performance, gives us PPS. It also has the raw data to generate the total electron count. And that thing is $100 more expensive. It's $155 in $100 quantity. But we can plug any of these chips out of the same board. We'll have footprints that support all three. So there'll be a range of performance capabilities. And by the way, for John's benefit, I've been saying all along that we get 10 megahertz out of the GPS module. And I know we would like to not have any 10 meg signals running around that might interfere with WWV for the grapes unit. Well, nothing says that we can't use 10.1 or 25 or 24.99 as that clock frequency. So we can move the clock frequency to something that's not going to generate any interference with any of the science applications. So I just wanted to make sure that that was known, that we can work around that issue. So these are the three modules, the bronze, silver, and gold. This is just the raw performance of the GPS by itself, the stability. And you can see the blue is the cheap one. The violet is the middle, the silver one, and the green is the dual frequency gold. And these are noticeable differences. Whether these are differences that anyone cares about is a different question, because they're all at 1 second offset much better than one part per billion.
So, but the green one is the only one that will have the TEC, right?
Correct. Right. So the trade-offs are depending on the science application, which GPS module you would want. But that's the raw performance. Now, this is the performance coming through the synthesizer chip. And again, this is using the different older chip, the 5328. We're going to use a 5344. The reason for this is that this evaluation board has the TCXO rather than the crystal oscillator. So here we can see what we're really getting out of the system with a loop bandwidth with a time constant of about 15 seconds or so of the PLL loop bandwidth. The blue is the cheap one, and you'll see there's some interesting wiggling around here at the very short term, at a second and below, that could cause potentially maybe some motorboating type effects, depending on how far down they are from the carrier. But either the mid-range or the silver, or I'm sorry, the silver or the gold are both very clean. We're down in the 2 to 3 parts in 10 to the minus 10th, and a nice tail off. This again is where the GPS takes over. So we get really nice performance out of this for the stability purposes, well in excess of our specification. Here's the phase noise. And again, this is a different chip. It's a little bit earlier design. And it's with the TCXO that's probably not optimized for ideal phase noise performance. But what you can see here is that at 100 kilohertz, we're down at about minus 135. So that's 5 or 6 dB worse than the plots that I showed before. I think we can make some of that up in our hardware design. As we get out at 100 hertz, we're down at minus 110. At 10 hertz, we're in the minus 90 range. So that's all nicely tracking our spec. You'll see there are a few spurs. And again, the cheap unit has more spurs than the fancier ones, but they're still not too bad at all. I've seen much, much worse than this from a lot of synthesizers. So this is a pretty usable RF spectrum. Now, this is interesting with Allen deviation, but I was taking 1,000 samples a second. So looking at the left side, this is a measurement interval of 1 millisecond, 10 milliseconds, 100 milliseconds, a second, 10, 100. And you see this interesting ringing showing up at the very short term in all of them, but it goes from a whole bunch on the cheapest unit to significantly less on the mid-range, and again, the F9 much, much better at anything except the very shortest term. So again, there is a little bit of noise performance that might show up as a, you know, sub-hertz kind of jitter with cheaper units, but I believe that these will all still be within useful range. It's not going to cause any problems in the real world, something that only shows up on laboratory instruments, I hope.
So do you have an explanation of why that oscillates like that?
It's most likely some kind of truncation in the DDS or whatever they're using to generate the 10 meg output. And if you look at it, it's sort of harmonic. If you go from here, we're at roughly 0.15. This is roughly 0.23, roughly 0.4. This is roughly 0.8. This is 1.2. So you get a sense that there's maybe a 400 millisecond thing going on in the output. And I think the magic is the more expensive units have faster clocks. So they probably have a cleaner, again, DDS or whatever they're using as their signal generator, probably a bit cleaner because it's clocking faster. Now, let's see. Sorry. That is...
Yeah, that was it's basically time quantization.
Yeah, yeah. Now, here's the phase noise impact of, and this is a little bit different view. This is looking at, and let me go back one. I think I got a slide mixed up. This should have been a different slide, which would be very cool to show you. I'll go back over here to the phase noise. This blue, again, these are all the F9T, the expensive unit. This is the phase noise of the raw 10 megahertz. Green is the phase noise with about a 2 hertz loop bandwidth. And you see it's, the floor is about the same, but you see more spurs here. The violet is the 0.088 or 15 second or so bandwidth, where the spurs are almost completely gone. So for optimum performance, we want to pick a bandwidth, and this is programmed when you configure the chip. There's about a dozen bandwidth options that you can select to get the short time constant, but still good enough to filter out all the crud to get the clean phase noise. So, and I had meant to show an ADEV plot showing the difference between the two different bandwidths for the stability, where the narrower bandwidth is actually worse for this receiver than the wide one, because the receiver is so good. We just have to have enough filtering to get rid of the phase noise. So that is about it. I could switch over and show you some, play around with some live plots, but I don't think we really need to do that because I've got most of what I wanted to show in the slides. So I will stop sharing, and I will be happy to answer questions or just shut up.
Actually, I have a question for you. The low-cost grape system, I was planning on using the 1PPS and the NEMA stream out of it to actually run the Linux system clock as a Stratum 1 reference. Would I have that accessible to me with your design, that I could also do that?
Yes, if you use the, well, two answers. Yes, if you use the cheapest GPS module, the $15 one, you can get the NEMA stream, but it only has one time pulse output, and we're using that output for the 10 megahertz, so we can't get a pulse per second. If getting the NEMA mark by itself is good enough, you would have that available. If you want to have a hardware pulse per second, you'd need to go to the middle receiver that has two outputs, where one of them can be PPS. So that would give you NEMA and a hardware pulse per second, as well as the 10 meg. So it depends on what you need, which module you'd have to use.
Yeah, actually, if you're generating the 1 PPS from somewhere else in the string, we could use that for it. It doesn't have to come straight out.
Well, the problem is we only have a single pulse output from the module. That okay. Pulse output is running at 10 megahertz. I can divide that back down to 1 hertz, but I have no idea where the top of the second is.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. So it sounds like the intermediate one is probably the one I'd be shooting for.
Yeah, unless just the ASCII stream alone is close enough for what you need to do.
Yeah, it's not looking for much, but that's, yeah.
I don't know whether it would be or not.
We'll find out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dave Whitten, if you could mute, we're getting a mouse coming through your microphone.
I could hear some squeaking of him twisting PVC pipe.
John, I've got a couple of comments in that this all looks very good, but from a ideal world standpoint, and in a real world, this isn't going to be always that good. If you lose a GPS lock, for instance, you're going to need something that's a good reference to hold over. So this doesn't show any holdover.
And I didn't mention that there is holdover built into the chip, and it's not incredibly sophisticated, but it will record, I think, up to a couple of minutes of prior history and apply that to hold the frequency during loss of external clock. So it'll run with the stability of the TCXO when there's no GPS present.
But that may not be adequate during
the
holdover.
Yeah.
I mean, the other part of it is that I'd be very nervous running from just a bare crystal.
Right. And we're not.
Because, well, it has to be at least a TCXO and a pretty good one.
Yeah.
Because, you know, real world in the winter when the furnace comes on and you got cold air and warm air blowing past this thing.
Right.
It's going to be all over the place.
Yeah. Although remember, that's only affecting it in this few second time range. But you are right that the raw crystal doesn't meet the spec that I had set for it. The TCXO is almost an order of magnitude better than the spec, and with a little bit of thermal management to keep drafts, you know, directly from blowing on the chip, I think we'll be well within the design margin using the TCXO. The problem is, this is getting down a rat hole a little bit, but Silicon Labs recommends for the best possible phase noise performance, they want you to use the bare crystal. With the TCXO, they warn that the jitter will not be quite as good. I've talked to their engineers, and we have a bit that we can do with conditioning the TCXO signal that we may be able to reduce the amount of that disadvantage.
Yeah, that's an interesting trade-off.
I think it's because with the crystal, the oscillator is internal, and it's directly feeding the differential, or it's directly feeding the internal clock. When you're using an external source, it's single-ended going into what is intended to be a differential input.
Right.
And so what we're going to do is there is a chip that Linear Technology makes that is designed to convert sine wave to differential LV Peckel output. Mm-hmm. So we think that by using that chip in between, maybe we can get rid of some of that noise disadvantage. And the Silicon Labs engineer sort of nodded his head yes when I talked about doing that. So we'll see if it really makes a difference or not.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm also wondering, in the Silicon Labs chip, do they give you any control over loop bandwidth?
Yes. Yeah, the loop bandwidth ranges from 4 kilohertz down to, and it actually depends, it changes a little bit depending on the frequencies you're using. It's kind of weird, but for the 10 meg test that I was doing, the minimum bandwidth is 0.088 hertz, which is, you know, if you think about it in terms of seconds, that's maybe a 15 second or so time constant.
Yeah. I want to see that electrolytic capacitor in there.
No, it's digital. That's what's interesting. The way this thing works is you have their clock builder software. You tell it the input frequencies, the output frequencies, what format you want for the differential, whatever. And then part of the steps is you can select the loop bandwidth. You can also select the a fast acquire. So if you're using a very narrow loop, you can have it start up with a fast lock. But it gives you, I think there are 16 choices, probably because it's an 8-bit or F4, whatever.
Right.
But they said the actual numbers change a little bit depending on what other variables you've plugged in. But it's in that range from 4 kilohertz to 0.088, and it's purely digital.
Yep. Well, it's certainly worth prototyping and working with it, but it looks like the phase noise is a bit higher than we were trying to target, about by 10 times higher.
Well, it's The tests that I've done now, I don't think are as good as we will get, because I'm also taking the output single-ended out of the thing, et cetera. It's not going to be at the 150 that we were hoping, but and Tom McDermott, if you want to jump in, I'd love it. We've talked about the actual requirement, and remember, this is minus 140 at 122 megahertz. We're going to be effectively dividing that down as we go into the HF range. We'll pick up something in the 10 to 20 dB range by the division. And so, Tom, correct me if I'm lying about that.
No, that's correct. The ADD converter, when it takes 10 or 15 samples, is going to average that across, you know, at 10 megahertz, 1/12 of the clock. So it should improve at a lower frequency.
Yep. Oh, and John, one very simple way of doing a single-ended to differential conversion on a clock, and very often done, is a transformer.
Yeah, I've got it. So backing up a little bit to the design, Silicon Labs has a nice evaluation board, and it's got SMAs for the pairs for the outputs and SMAs for the inputs, and I can unsolder the crystal and SMAs for the TCXO if I want to put it on. So arriving Friday from China is a couple of circuit boards that I laid out with matching SMAs. So one of them is a transformer and a balun for the output side. The other is a TCXO with the single to differential chip for the input side, or for the jitter reference side. So with those pieces, I should be able to prototype pretty closely to what the final system will look like without having to lay out the whole thing. So it's but given the results that we've had so far, I'm really confident that with the possible exception of the edges around the phase noise, it's going to do everything we want for a dramatically lower cost and a much simpler design.
Now, are you feeding it the uncompensated pulse per second or whichever in? So you're not using the sawtooth correction.
Right. And that's what's kind of amazing. Let me, if I can find the right slide. Yeah, this, no, that's not the right one. Or down.
Actually, John, while you're looking for that, I want to throw something out here. When I was at Keithley Instruments, the last DMM I worked on, which was their 7510, had a crystallized voltage reference that I designed the oven for. And it basically used 8 resistors, a temperature sensor, and an op amp for a PID loop. And we were able to maintain, you know, plus or minus a tenth of a degree on this ovenized thing. And the oven was only about a half inch by an inch, and it was 4 layers of copper. And you coupled the thing to the copper plane, and you put a little box around it, so it would maintain the temperature. What would that gain you if you were to do that to the TCXO crystal? Significant advantage, or not worth the time?
I thought a little bit about it, and it might be helpful for a system that's being exposed to temperature excursions. My only concern is that this is a very small board, and the TCXO is actually bigger than the synthesizer chip. But the synthesizer chip makes a fair bit of heat, so I'm a little bit concerned about whether we could get the thermals working so that we can heat the TCXO to a constant temperature and not have either the heat from the chip impacting it or the chip overheating because of the proximity of the oven.
Well, I can show you some neat tricks that I played with routing on the board, that I routed all 4 edges so that the heat transfer in had to go through a really long path. And the board was basically completely isolated from the PC board right in the middle of it. So it's dual.
I'd certainly be interested in thinking about doing that. Okay. I don't think we need it for the base case, but if we can do it, it's cool. Yeah. I don't have any problems with the idea. I'm going to share again. And again, what's the thing that's remarkable about, okay. Okay, got it?
Yep.
Okay, so again, this was earlier in the presentation. The blue line is just the raw pulse per second coming out of the ZF9, the dual frequency module. The violet is the error correction, which makes a big difference. You know, it's an order of magnitude improvement. But I had no idea that the 10 megahertz output would be way better out, you know, to 50 seconds or so. And then I think if we're doing apples to apples measurements, because the green line was a little bit different measurement setup than the other two, it would track identically probably from you know, 50 or 60 seconds on out. But shorter than that, the raw 10 megahertz is way better than the corrected pulse per second. And that just blew me away when I saw it. And that's why I kind of, you know, put on the brakes and went back and started from scratch, because this is just,
yeah, it was
an incredible result.
Simpler is better. That's impressive.
Yeah. I
wonder
don't
if that's frequency dependent. If you took it up to 25 megahertz, if you get a little more improvement.
Well, that's a really good point. And I already have about 15 variables that I can use multiple combinations of.
Yeah.
But at some point I want to do at least gross level testing of, you know, 100 kilohertz versus 1 versus 10 versus 25. And then also an integer frequency like 10 versus 11.11111 to see whether there are more spurs generated or other bad things that happen with
the number dividing and all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. those are further tests to be done, but it's been hard enough figuring out how the loop bandwidth plays into the stability and the phase noise across the three different receivers.
But I think you stumbled onto something that is very significant for the simplicity of it. That's incredible.
Yeah.
You get four old stars and a go home early card.
John. So John, does this attenuate the jitter of the pulse per second as well as the RF reference?
No, because what we are doing is, it's the output pulse that would normally be pulse per second, we're telling the GPS to output 10 megahertz instead of one pulse per second.
Right. So you're losing the accuracy of the one pulse per second. There are applications we're going to want that as accurate as well as having low phase noise.
Right. The cheapest GPS module only has one pulse output. So if you use the $15 module, you don't get pulse per second, but either of the other two modules have two pulse outputs. So one of them is the 10 meg, the other is the pulse per second.
Yep.
So John, going back to the phase noise requirements, could we say perhaps that the personal space weather station is not going to be as demanding on phase noise requirements as, say, a high performance HF receiver? Is that a correct statement or no?
I don't know the answer to that. Tom would have a much better answer, but I also would say, I suspect that the performance that we'll get with this chip is probably as good as just about any of the Japanese or Texas radios that are currently out there.
The point I wanted to make though was if you're really concerned with phase noise above everything else, above and maybe above even making TEC measurements, then we can make a different clock module that has low phase noise if there's an application for it. If not, then you can use one of these and it will be fine.
Yeah, really, you know, there's a bunch of different kinds of measurements. And so there's some cases where Allen deviation is very important. There's other applications where phase noise is important. So John's juggling about 20 variables here. John, to go back to David's question, on the dual pulse output, can you get corrected PPS out as well as the 10 megahertz?
Yes.
Okay.
You can get the hardware PPS with a software correction measure.
So the correction would be done external to the module.
Yes.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
But the one PPS for the low cost station is just kicking off the data acquisition 8 kilohertz sample block for that 1 second. So if it's off 50 nanoseconds, I don't care. It's not going to affect me that much. because I'm, you know, sampling at a much slower rate base, but I'm starting off of that. So it's my starting time, but it, you know, a 50 nanosecond error isn't going to hurt me that much.
Yeah, given that that's a cycle of 20 megs.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I wish we could get the pulse per second out of the cheapest module, but they don't make that. You know, I mean, you could always use another external GPS for the timing as well.
I'm using one now. I think it's from Adafruit. It's like a $30 GPS, and yeah. I've got a board laid out, and it's doing just fine as a Stratum 1 times time standard. But that's $30 for that GPS.
Yeah.
And if I could use the $15 one to do that, I might make more sense. And then, but
yeah, why the $15 one needs a few bucks worth of other parts around it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if having two GPSs is really the right thing to do.
You're better off spending the $55 and getting both better performance plus the pulse.
I completely
there may be some different manufacturer's module that would be more appropriate as well.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
$55
have to look for it.
Is way over your budget, John.
My budget's been torpedoed already, so
yeah,
I got somebody holes on my backside.
There are some other GPS manufacturers that are making really good stuff, but the U-Blox is widely available. They make documentation available, and the others like Furuno has apparently some good modules. Trimble has some, but hobbyists have a great deal of difficulty getting at them. And U-Blox has a good reputation, and so there could be something else that could work as well or better. But I think with the U-Blox, we're going down a path that's supportable and workable.
Just so everybody knows, I put up on the HamSci website, there are 20 pictures of a teardown of Leo Bodnar GPSDO internals. Yeah. Well, actually, reverse engineering is legal.
Oh, I know it is. I just this is me being
super
what I am. I don't want anybody to say that I got my idea from Leo.
Yeah.
And for the rest of the group, I think Leo may be doing something similar to this. It's not the same design, but I think he may have the same kind of architecture in his unit. I'm basing that only on what I've seen in terms of his published documentation, but I really want this design to be able to say it has nothing to do with Leo's. So I'm not going to look at your beautiful teardown.
I understand.
Not until you're done anyway.
So John, how do they get the one PPS output? Do they derive it from the 10 megahertz or what? I know on the cheap one, they don't have that output, but on the more expensive one, what do they do to generate that?
Well, there are the two outputs can be either one of them can be set to whatever frequency you want.
So could you on the cheap one then with one output get a one PPS but no 10 megahertz if
right.
you were so inclined?
Right, but then you wouldn't be able to discipline.
Right, it wouldn't work with this architecture.
Right, right. Well, actually, if you are perverse.
I am perverse.
This is a perverse group.
You could configure the SI Labs chip to free run off the TCXO and use the pulse output for pulse per second, and then your frequency stability would just be the free running TCXO if that were good enough for your application.
So
I don't think it is. Probably, but
that's something that we could do with the FPGA on the data engine. We could do some magic over there because we have some logic. If we have the IOs to do it, I'm not quite understanding what you're saying that we should do. But if we have visibility of all those signals, then
yeah, I'm not saying you should. I'm saying you just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it.
Oh well, if I I got to try it.
I think what you're saying is you can from the 10 megahertz coming off of the Silicon Labs, you can create a one pulse per second for that and then lock it externally through the FPGA, which was what John was trying to avoid in the first place.
Right. And the problem is you still have to have something to lock it to.
Right.
And if we don't have a pulse per second coming from the GPS, I can give you a wonderful pulse per second, but I can't synchronize it to UTC.
Right.
And that's the
minor detail.
That's the problem.
Well, so you can guarantee that the pulse per second is exactly 1.0 seconds, but you can't tell me where it is.
Exactly.
Well, John, when you're 10 megahertz out in node PPS, it's still putting out it's putting out the serial data.
Yeah, you
can actually synchronize to that.
Yeah, you can get
one of the 10 million output edges is actually the one PPS edge, so you just have to pick the right one.
Well, it's the first one.
on the ASCII stream, you know, typically there is an ASCII message that's fairly closely aligned to the top of the second.
Right.
So if you look in the serial stream for the beginning of the message, you might be able to get within 50 or 100 milliseconds that way. It's hard to do much better than that.
It'll get better because they're putting that out on the same clock that they're putting all the other stuff out. They're the same.
It's a question of whether they bother to align it.
Right. Well, some modules do.
Yeah. And I don't know the answer to that. Yeah.
I'm just thinking you might be able to get a reasonable enough 1 PPS and 10 megahertz by using some logic in the FPGA that we will have on the data engine that you might not have in other cases.
Yeah, it's entirely possible.
I could see that the Time Nuts version of this, probably those guys are not going to buy the cheap one. I mean, why would you do that? I mean, you want accuracy, you want the fancy one, otherwise why bother?
Actually, most of the Time Nuts will buy the version with no GPS at all because they're going to use it as a synthesizer or for failover. And by the way, that's the other thing. I went to a couple of my Time Nuts friends on Sunday and said, you know, I just realized something we can do with this chip. It's got 4 clock inputs and it will fail over from one. If input 1 goes away, it will switch to input 2 and the phase lock will smooth that out. So this is now a device that if you have multiple frequency standards, you can pump them all in, get your output, and if any of your oscillators fails, you continue with your house standard without interruption.
This is why you want the clock inputs on the connector, right?
Well, that's why I asked you to add those extra pins.
Well, they're already there, so
yeah. Now there's two different ways of doing holdover too, though, and we have to address that for different applications. One is to hold the frequency constant and let the pulse per second drift, and the other is to bring the pulse per second into line when you get.
We're not dealing with pulse per second in this model. Remember, pulse per second is just coming raw from the GPS. If we lose GPS lock, we lose pulse per second.
That's not good. You have to be able to keep a pulse per second through holdover.
Well, couldn't you do this in the GPS if you're feeding the 1 PPS in the FPGA? Sorry, you could do it in the FPGA.
Well, the
holdover that way, and I mean, the FPGA can divide down to 1 PPS. It's just not going to be aligned to anything.
Well, the GPS, if you lose lock, the GPS could continue to provide pulse per second. There's no guarantee on how accurate it's going to be.
Well,
it'll be up to the stability of the
be accurate. It has to be the pulse per second that would come out of a GPS DO.
But it'll be accurate based upon the 10 megahertz that is not accurate anymore because there's no lock.
Well, it'll be accurate based on whatever the oscillator is inside the GPS module.
Right.
And for the low-cost personal space weather station, that's one of the concessions we will make because it's a low-cost system and you just have to live with it. And if your antenna's up on the roof and you always got a good signal, chances are you'll be fine.
But that kills some of the applications.
Well, you just mark data as invalid if you lose GPS lock. I mean, what can you do?
Yeah.
We're talking about a couple of units here and not just, these aren't all the same radio.
Yeah. Well, so I'm saying that at least the good module needs to have a holdover PPS.
Well, but the problem is it's the same circuit board in each case. It's just which GPS module we install.
But the personal station needs the expensive GPS because we want to do TEC.
Yeah.
So you're going to use the platinum or gold or whatever the high end one is.
Well, but even that one though, and David's got a good point. that the pulse per second, even from the high end, is generated by the GPS module. And by, so it can continue to provide PPS when lock is lost. We don't know how much that may wobble at that time, but we don't have a holdover flywheel on the pulse per second signal.
And we also don't have control over whether it drifts back into time or if it jam syncs.
Right.
You mean when lock comes back?
Yeah, when lock comes back, when it regains the GPS signal,
yeah.
There are two ways of handling holdover. And one is to jam sync it, and the other is to drift it back so you don't have a discontinuity.
Yeah. Now back to Scotty's point, though. You know, if assuming we've got the 10 megahertz that has at least modest holdover, the synthesizer output will have at least modest holdover based on the TCXO. That's going into the data engine along with the pulse per second. Scotty could, in the data engine, generate pulse per second from the synthesizer output and synchronize that with pulse per second from GPS when that's valid.
Which would give us holdover.
And get holdover that way.
Now, you said that the time nuts would like the stripped down board. Are you saying that those of us who have a good GPS DO, we just use that and put it into this?
Because a good GPS DO is going to be better than this because it's not as, you know, it's cost constrained. But what this thing does for time dots is I've got four outputs that I can program to whatever frequency I want, anywhere from a 10 hertz or whatever it is to a gigahertz. So VHFers will like this as well.
Indeed.
So it's the synthesizer capability, and then it's also this failover capability. So again, I've got three GPS DOs. I can plug all three of them into this guy, program the four outputs to say 1 megahertz, 5, 10, 15 megahertz. That then becomes my house standard. And if I lose one of my GPS DOs, it'll seamlessly fail over to the other one. My house standard only has a momentary phase drift while it resyncs.
John, maybe what's missing here is that the idea of having a separate time nuts carrier board for the clock module to provide all this interconnect, which is, I don't think we discussed that at all.
Michael just put into the chat exactly what I was going to bring up too, is that if we put in our own GPS, it won't have TEC available, which is something we very definitely want for personal space weather station.
And I'm assuming TEC is not part of the low cost system. Is that correct?
Well, no, but
Daniel.
Well, TEC is just a pass through from the GPS module.
You know, TEC was not a requirement of the low cost personal space weather station.
Not for low cost, but we do want to we want to encourage people to have it out there because it's extremely useful.
Valuable, yeah.
Number.
My takeaway from this is that John's clock module is going to provide me the 2.5, 5, 10, and 15 carrier kilohertz or megahertz carriers a kilohertz down.
Yep. I can give that to you.
Oh, that is fantastic because that simplifies so many things for me.
John, so if we were to use the gold version with the dual frequency GPS on it, the expensive module, we can still route the external inputs of the synthesizer to the connector so that if you took that expensive module and put it on your time nuts carrier board, you still have the clock fold over. So you can still do that, even if you have the GPS on it. The only difference is, and then could you also feed a more accurate GPS into the system? Are there hooks on the board to be able to do that if you have GPS installed on the system already, on the board already?
There will be a hook on the board to plug in an external reference.
Okay.
So
you could use the high-end GPS on the clock module to do TEC, and then have your Trimble super califragilistic one that does not do TEC, but you could still feed it in as a reference.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've got a novice question, if I could ask it here. There's something in my throat. could somebody address, or if it's out of left field, let me know, how we're going to get from these GPS synchronized pulses to time stamping sample data. How is that link made?
The way I am doing it in the low cost station is setting up the Raspberry Pi to be the Stratum 1 time reference off of the GPS model data stream and the one pulse per second. So the timestamp in the operating system is accurately synced to the one PPS. And that's how I am getting an accurate timestamp for the data.
Yep. We'll do this. But that's accurate to milliseconds, not nanoseconds.
Yeah. For the higher performance one, it's going, the plan is to do it in the FPGA itself, where the samples will be aligned on a packet boundary by the PPS signal. So that'll be in the FPGA.
All right. So when you actually ask for data, we're going to wait to give you the data until we get a PPS boundary and then start synchronizing.
And you're going to timestamp the packet?
Correct. And then you'll be able to timestamp all the subsequent packets by just counting.
But just counting. Where does that initial time reference come from? Are you pulling it off the GPS?
Yes.
Yeah, the PPS goes into the FPGA itself.
And so that gives you a second. That doesn't tell you what time of day it is.
Serial data comes into the FPGA also from the GPS.
So you're going to get the serial synthesized time from...
Right. But and we'll decode that and build the actual time off of that.
Is there a synchronization issue there?
Well, we'll synchronize with the one PPS, but we'll know what second it is by reading the data from the GPS.
Okay. That makes sense.
That answer?
Yeah.
That's a good question. Do we have an explicit real-time clock separate from the GPS?
Actually, there is one on the data engine. And I don't know what's on the Raspberry Pi. I think it's optional.
I don't think the Raspberry Pi has a real-time clock on it.
No. You can buy it.
No, you can add it to it.
You can add it, but I haven't done that. I don't know if that was necessary or not to do that.
Yeah, I don't know if it has.
It's explicit to add. It's still a possibility, but...
Well, the software knows what time it is. What day it is, but it's a matter of how accurate do you want it, and is it going to keep it when you power down?
Well, the issue I have is if you have a power failure with the Raspberry Pi, when you bring it back up with, I've got it synced up to an NTP server, and it only sets the time exactly 1 minute after it boots. So for that 1 minute, it's off anywhere from 10 minutes to an hour and a half. So I get a time jump. And I've got software right now that's fixing that. And then the file also has nulls shoved into it because it got truncated and shut off without the file allocation table being updated. So we've got fixes in place for that, but I'm trying to figure out a way of not starting the collection process till I know the clock is synced.
So in the data engine, we'll be depending upon the GPS to get that time. So we'll be in the same boat you're in while the GPS locks if power comes back on.
There was also some talk about loss of lock. Is there some mechanism to get the GPS loss of signal into the FPGA?
There are a couple of lock status pins available. I'm not sure. The GPS might have to be actually parsing a message in the serial stream. The synthesizer chip has a loss of lock indicator. So if the synth chip would lose its 10 megahertz in, it would, I've got it set now to turn on an LED, but obviously that could be a signal.
Is that something the GPS or the FPGA needs to see?
I don't know. I don't.
The FPGA, I would think it would.
It'll relock. If the signal comes back, it will automatically relock. But if you want to flag that something happened, that would be,
if we're taking scientific data, you want to know, is it accurate or is it not?
Right. You know, the Adafruit GPS that I'm using now does have a lock indicator on it that comes right out of the GPS and I'm looking at it.
Is there one on the GPS, John?
Well, what's interesting, there are several signals that there's no pin that says GPS lock, but I think there may be pins with other purposes that can be set to essentially do that. I need to dig through the reference manuals a little bit more to figure that out.
And the other thing, if the FPGA is receiving serial data from the GPS, I mean, there's probably a bit in that stream somewhere.
Yep.
This is locked or not.
Yeah, we can get a status message every second that tells us whether we're locked.
Is that sufficient? I mean, once per second? We have a couple extra IO pins on the connectors. All I'm saying is we might connect up the clock chip, loss of lock to one of those.
Yeah.
I know the NEMA stream tells me in real time the number of satellites it's locked to, and it's typically 8, 9, 10. It lists the satellite number in the NEMA stream as to who's locked.
And then if it comes back with 3, you know you're in trouble.
Actually, you only need 1 for a timestamp.
Oh,
so it
now, John, I haven't used the U-blocks that much.
But you only need 1 for a timestamp.
John, I haven't used the U-blocks that much. Does it have a binary stream as opposed to the NEMA? The problem that the NEMA gives is that it tells you the time that it was, not the time that it's going to be.
There, you can select NEMA or UBlox binary with great granularity of what it outputs. And on the F9 chip, there are actually 4 interfaces. There's USB, there's I2C, and there are 2 UARTs, and you can program each of those interfaces separately with to have different message streams.
Oh my gosh, sign me up. I want one.
And we have multiple of those connections back to the FPGA, so
right
John, they're not all connected because the GPS or the USB is off board, right? Goes to a connector.
The consumer UART, right?
But more than one of the other ports goes to the M.2 connector.
Correct? Yeah, the way it's configured now, one UART and the I2C go to the M.2 connector. The other UART goes to a header for other uses.
Okay, and we still have IO pins left, COM IO pins for loss of lock, or if we need something like that from the synthesizer chip.
Scotty, do you have the assigned IO pins on the 40 pin header document ready yet so I can drool over it and make sure I
the 40 pin header or the almost
okay. When you get a preliminary shoot one at me to make sure I haven't done anything stupid.
What I did is I went through the pinout that you gave me about a month ago and make sure that we have connections to all of those pins so that we can run the grape off of the DE if we want to.
Okay.
That makes sense. But I'll say
I want to keep in sync with you on that because I don't want to diverge because that'll cause problems down the road that I don't want to get into.
Hey guys, I'm going to have to sign off your.
Yeah, I was.
My eyeballs are about to fall out.
Oh my!
If anybody has any last questions, I'd be happy to take them. Otherwise, we can email.
Yeah, I was going to say that we're 40 minutes past our normal time, and
it was well worth it though.
It's a good discussion.
Yeah. Thank you.
I learned a lot.
Thanks, John.
John Ackman, you did a phenomenal job. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. If you are on the clock mailing list, I think there only are about 6 people. Earlier this afternoon, I sent out the slide deck and also the current version of the schematic. And that stuff's available. I just, particularly the schematic, don't hold me to anything because it's still getting stared at and tweaked on.
John, if people want to join that list, they can
just let me know. Let me know and I'll sign them up.
Scotty, did you send me the final schematic for the magnetometer board?
I don't think so. Was I supposed to?
Yeah, because I'm going to incorporate it on my low-cost version.
Okay.
I'm just going to be having the RJ45 connector coming out of that.
Okay. I was supposed to put it up on the server, but I think I probably spaced it out. So
there is one in the documents, Scotty.
Is it the XD1?
I don't know.
Okay.
But there is a PDF of the schematic.
We'll catch y'all later.
Later, John.
73.
Stay healthy.
73.
Bye.
73, guys.
John, did you set your in your ncp.com on your Raspberry Pi? I use, I believe it's Tinker Panic Zero, so it will it'll automatically set the clock when it comes up. Do you have that in your configuration file?
Right now what I'm doing is I'm in the process of actually setting it up that the Raspberry Pi is a Stratum 1 time standard. And one of the issues I'm having is that auto baud rates on the clock, and you get better granularity of the timestamp if you run it at 115K baud, but it defaults to 9600 and works its way up. So it takes about 3 minutes before it finds it. So I'm trying to find a configuration file in the Linux OS to tell it that the initial baud rate is 115K baud, so it comes up right away. And that should eliminate my 1 minute up time before the clock gets set. That's what I'm fighting right now.
Are you using GPS, Damon?
Yes, I believe so. But I noticed there's another one out that I was going to look at. If you have any insight into that or references or good ideas, yes, please send them to me. I'm very much open to that because I need all the help I can get.
Well, basically boils down to downloading the latest version from the from GitHub and okay, building it. The newer version has runtime options for speed and for speed and framing.
And so I
use that on my VLF system that I have here, with my Trimble. So it actually, as soon as it comes up, it's accepting binary data from the serial port. So
can you send me the link to that GitHub reference so I can take a look at it? Could you put it in the chat window maybe so I can look at it?
Yeah, it's the GPST code. Let me find it for you.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hey, John, the latest schematic XD1 is already up there. I put it up last week. So,
is this on the official Nathaniel set up? No, I seem to be the only one contributing to that one.
No, it's on the homepage for Tangerine SDR.
Oh, okay.
Under working documents.
Okay.
And it's MagnetoPi hat schematic __XD1. I don't know why there's two underscores, but it's XD1.
XD1. Okay. I'm going to write that down.
That's the version that everyone received.
They're okay.
Were sent out.
Got it. Actually, I'll put that in my AmSci notebook. What a concept.
Everyone, I'm going to say goodnight for the night.
Yeah, you look like you're fading, Nathaniel.
Yeah, I always struggle with Monday nights.
So, Nathaniel, you're the host. So, what do you.
I'll just make you the host, Scotty.
Okay, you can
make whoever you want the host when you leave.
Till death.
Do you want me to leave it recording or turn it off?
You can turn it off, I guess.
All right, so
I'm going to sign out also, guys. 73, I've got some stuff going on tomorrow. Bill. I need to be
73, Bill.
Good night, Bill.
Good evening, 73. We'll catch you next time.
Stay healthy.
All right, Scotty, you're going to be the host. Have a good night.
So the version was XD0?
X-ray Delta 1.
X-ray Delta 1. Got it.
The way I work my revisions is they all begin with X, and they go XA, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, to however many you need. And then once you get build a prototype, then it becomes A1, or just A, becomes A. And then whenever you make a mistake, you go to XB1, and that becomes the new rev, and you go XB, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, however many you need. And so numbers are cheap. I've seen XA20s, because you just, if every time it leaves here and it goes somewhere else, it gets a new number. And then the camera comes back, it gets a new number just to keep them all separate. And then once we actually commit to real hardware, then it becomes just the letter. And then we bump the letter up to the next one and start over again. So that's why we really had XC1 was the one with the connector facing out, and XD1 was the one with the connector turned 90 degrees. And it seems to me there's justification for both. And like in your case, I think if you just plug an extender in, I think that the board will plug right into your stack there.
Yeah, if I extend the 40-pin header with another socket that has long enough tails on it, that'll work fine.
Do you want me to send you one?
No, I can order some.
Well, I've got them here. I have extra ones, so I can drop
an envelope. I'll need six.
Let me look and see how many I've got.
I was going to say, I can just go ahead and order them. In fact, if you just send me the part number, I'll order from Digi-Key. I'll have them today.
Okay. Yeah, well, you ordered them from England, but you can order from DigiKey if you're just buying a few, because they're like $2.50 from DigiKey and 89 cents from England. So if you buy a lot of them,
like that.
But it's 89 cents plus 89 cents postage. Literally, it was $35 to buy them out, and then it was $35 shipping. So if you're buying a couple of three, then DigiKey is a good deal.
Yeah,
buying a lot. Then.
Now, would it be possible for that RJ45 to rotate so it's pointed off the end of the board instead of off the side?
That's the way it is with XC1s.
Oh,
but if you do that, it won't fit on a Raspberry Pi because it hits the USB connectors. In your case, it won't, because you're going to jack it up high above them, so it will work fine for you.
Yeah, because the Raspberry Pi 4s, even with the heat sinks, this connector you have there, they won't fit. You hit the heat sinks.
For height, right?
Yeah, you need it for height, because you have to have a fan with a Pi 4, otherwise it overheats, and during the boot, it'll thermal back cut back.
Well, interestingly enough, I should have sent you one of these also. I have 5 RevC boards that have the connector rotated.
Ooh.
Yeah, but I only have 5 now, and the jury's out as to what we're actually going to manufacture, because people don't care that it's right angle.
Well, for me putting it in the pipe, I have to have it right angle, because otherwise I'm going to have to unsolder the connectors.
I think out of the wires directly into the
board.
I know Dave's going to want the right angle ones, the straight
ones. Is there any possibility of putting it facing the opposite end of the... actually moving the footprint.
Get the camera here. This is the 1.5.
Move it over to the left side of the board.
And this goes in, and you can see the connector here hits.
Yeah. Well, my only suggestion to you is your pipe's too small. Okay.
Yeah, I'm using 3-inch.
You need a pipe stretcher.
Well, I mean,
you're going to need a bigger pipe.
Dave's using 3. So. With 3-inch pipe, Dave, does it fit sideways?
2-inch pipe will fit. This is 1.5-inch.
Okay.
Yeah,
2-inch it'll fit. Yeah,
guys, I'm using 2-inch and for the Scotty module, and I'm going to directly wire. I'm not using the connector. I'm directly wiring to an extension that is then goes to a connector at the top of the pipe.
Oh, okay. I like that. Also, when you populate the remote board, Scotty, you don't need to put in the 40-pin header.
I know, but all the boards are the same. So that's why you got the 40-pin header.
Because this header has to move down 300 thousandths, and it won't fit in a 1.5-inch pipe then if you do that.
Your pipe's too small.
Yeah.
Go to 2-inch pipe. I mean, I don't know what to tell you, because the whole point of making one board was to make them all the same.
Yeah.
And now we already have 2 cases where we want one that has one coming off the end. We want one coming off the right. And then we want one with the header or without the header. So if we're going to make 2 separate boards, we could turn the connector 90 and we could take the header off. And that would be the remote board. But now I got 2 part numbers. I have to stock 2 different part numbers, which is, I mean, if it has to be, it has to be. I'm just trying to
I understand what you're trying to do.
The illusion of my one board as long as I can.
Well, the other thing you can do is look at the using a different type of connector. The MIDI connectors are available in right angle. They're available in 45 degree. They're available a lot of different ways.
So what would happen if I were to take that connector and put a vertical one on so that it came directly up off the board? Would that solve both problems? I mean, John and Dave, you have both.
Yeah, coming straight up, you can see, I think it's still heavy.
I'm not going to solve your problem with that pipe. It's too small. You need a 2-inch pipe.
I'm going to be stubborn.
Get your Dremel out and carve it off.
You can still do if you use a 3-inch auger, I mean, the 2-inch and 3-inch augers are cheap.
I've actually got one of both.
A 2-inch pipe fits in very nicely if you into the 3-inch hole, because the outside diameter is just under 2.5 inches.
So how far apart should I be burying these things with, horizontally for the 2 I'm going to bury? Should they be within a foot of each other, 10 feet, 3 feet?
Well, I've got mine 6 inches apart.
6 inches? Okay.
In the test unit. The test unit that I'm running right now in the same housing has 2 boards. And this is actually the original board that Dave designed, because I didn't get Scotty's boards until today. Those are, they're probably closer to 4.5, 5 inches apart.
So they're
and I don't see any interaction at all between the mags.
And those are stacked in one pipe, one over each other?
That is correct. They're vertically stacked.
Oh, okay.
Interesting. So, Dave Witten, before I didn't hear the answer because everybody was talking. So did you say a 3-inch pipe would fit the board sideways or not?
Well, it's still not great. But yes, you can get a right angle RJ45 cables that will work then pretty well.
So you still put the board in narrow wise down into the pipe as opposed to wide wise down into the pipe.
Well, I haven't absolutely finished trying all the possibilities, but I'm working on it. Tomorrow we'll tell.
Okay.
Another option is I would swear to you need to use 2-inch, but to use a 2-inch T. And I don't have all the pieces here, but here's put a cap on each end, have the RJ45 going this way, pointing this way, the rest of the board here.
Okay.
And still you're going to need 2-inch. But you have to dig a bigger hole in this end and put it.
Yeah.
I'm not planning to really try this myself. I have just about every possible fitting for schedule 40 pipe that's known.
Well, this is the whole point of doing the prototype is to try and figure out what's the best alternative. And keep in mind that we can put the cable out the side like the ones you got. We can rotate it 90 and come off the end if we have to, but that's going to cause an interference problem with the Raspberry Pi unless we raise the board. Or we could come off vertically and come straight up off the board like this and bend the cable over. And for 2-inch pipe, that might actually be the best way to do it.
I will be posting some photographs of probably 1.5, 2, and 3-inch creations I have made that are varying degrees of complexity, all of them really a bit too much. But since I wanted to try them, they're okay with me. I did find that I think the 2-inch pipe goes very nicely in the larger, in the holes, the larger auger I bought. They came in a pair off Amazon. And that fits very well with plenty of room around it. Probably needs to be filled in. For the 3-inch pipe, you have to go to a post hole digger, and which I'm indebted to Dave Larson. But my problem around here is that I've got too much limestone bedrock and I can't go very deep. I'm going to experiment with building up from around it.
Like
if you really, really wanted to control the temperature, you dig a hole and bury a 5-gallon bucket, put your whole thing, your whole contraption down in there, fill it with water so it had really a lot of thermal inertia.
And you have to blast to get the hole.
Where are you located? Would.
I'm in Missouri. on the northern edge of the Ozark, the karst that drops off to the Missouri River.
Isn't there a geological fault that runs right through there?
Not here. No, that's down. That's down there in the corner. Hopefully.
Hopefully. So you don't trigger anything when you drill down there.
I doubt I will. No.
just a couple of comments on once you get the hole dug and are ready to embed this thing. And again, mine are typically in vertical format. So I've rotated the board essentially 90 degrees, which changes the Z axis now becomes the X axis.
Right.
Okay. So with a 3-inch auger and the 1.5-inch pipe or the 2-inch pipe, there is space around the hole. Now I have Dave and I think are using the same technique. At the top of the pipe, there's a cap that has mounted on it a level, a spirit level, 2-axis spirit level, or one of the larger 60 millimeter bubble levels. So you can actually level the hole arrangement as you're holding it in place. And then I'm using dry Mason sand, which I then pour around it and keeping the thing vertical while I'm doing that. Mm. I pour the Mason sand around it rather than trying to backfill it with soil. And that's what I've tried on this one. And so far, that seems to be working pretty well.
So Jules, do you think that we can compensate for the fact that whether the module is mounted horizontally or vertically in software?
Yes.
And I plan to have options for that in the...
Okay.
As soon as I can get... Tomorrow, I probably will go back to work on the software and start putting... I'm going to get rid of some of the options that are there, and I'm going to add some seem more relevant.
And you're working in C?
Yeah, this is okay, all good. In C.
That's what I'll send you my stuff in then.
Yeah, so, I can Python works nicely too. But
with the bubble level, then you can guarantee that you're going to get the thing vertical, but you still have an azimuth problem of where you aim it, right?
Well, that's fairly easy because you can mark a north or south line on one side of the pipe. And for example, at the top of the pipe, I've got a T fitting. From the side of the T, I've got a waterproof RJ45 connector coming out of that. But I orient the module inside so that it's lined up
with the T.
And I've got it, yeah. So I've lined, and I can essentially set it with a compass pretty accurately, but I still have to do a fine adjustment because I can get down to about within 1 or 2 degrees with a compass, but then I need to do a fine adjustment while I'm observing the magnetometer to actually zero that x-axis out.
Which means you could do that in software. Could you do that?
No, it's so easy.
A correction vector, you should be able to just apply to realign it.
Calibrate it.
It's so easy to do it physically, but as Hyman said, that can change from time to time too. So that would, but that's an actual field change. At the time of installation, if you do an alignment so that you've zeroed it out, okay, fine, that's what you've got to start with, and then just track it from there.
Right, because the magnetic north is moving, right? So
Because magnetic declination in Cleveland is +8 degrees. And I know at my son's house in Laurel, Maryland, which is by Washington, D.C., it's +11.5 degrees.
Yeah, but we're 13.5 here.
Yeah, so well, it's all over the place.
I'm almost zero.
To make this easy, I don't know how critical vertical is. I don't know how critical azimuth is. It sounds like azimuth, once you get it vertical, that you can just calibrate out. And that way you would let the user just put it in the ground, look north somewhere and put it about that way. And you don't really have to get down to within 2 degrees. So it saves them a lot of heartache trying to figure out exactly what.
I'm pretty sure that even though you could do that, you're going to sacrifice some sensitivity in not optimizing the initial position. You can tweak it later on. I can't put that into good, geophysical terms, but I believe that's probably the case. If you can null it maybe in software, but it's not going to be as good as if you try and do it right.
It's not going to be, once you have it set, it's not going to be moving that much. It's just, is the plus or minus zero going to give you an accurate representation if you're jumping from plus to minus all the time?
Well, and you see where I'm getting at is you're going to have instructions on how to install this. Do we want to make it important for the people to accurately aim it, or are we making it harder than it needs to be? That's the question.
I don't think you just shove it in the ground any way you want and just have a correction vector as long as you're close.
But like Dave says, you might sacrifice your accuracy that way.
We might want to wait for some advice from Hyman.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the best way to go. We're just guessing here.
Yeah. Those things should options along these lines should appear in the software in the next few days. But don't expect everything to be there at the first moment.
My
two axis bubble things, bubble level things, I've gotten those from what's it called, MPJA.
Yep.
It's somebody who sends me stuff every week, and I try hard not to look at them because there's always something I think could be useful. Well, I clicked on those one time, so that's what we're fooling with right now.
These are the round ones, right, with a circle and the bubble that
No, these aren't. This one, no, this one isn't isn't round. It's kind of I may have sent you some that were round, but these are ones that are kind of a T because there's two different axes, two different bubbles.
I have for field day, we use AB 577 rocket launchers. They call them rocket launchers, but they have a level on them, which is a round liquid level with a bubble in it, and it's a dome. So it's a circle stamped on it, and it will tell you when in both axes, in all axes at the same time, when that tower is vertical.
Just ordered a couple of those. Yes, you can do that. Correct. And that's where I mounted mine on the top, on the cap, or the plug, I should say. Well,
did you make that yourself, John, or is that a...
No. These are, I think they're $1.50, Home Depot.
For the PVC cap.
Yeah.
I'm talking about a level indicator.
Oh. Yeah, right. And however, the level indicator you're talking about, Scotty, fits very nicely on top of that cap. It's nice and flat. Yeah. And where you can epoxy it to it or silicon rubber to it, whatever. Because and they're good. Flat, right? Yes, and the inner circle on those things is 1 degree. Mm. So they're quite accurate.
Okay. Because I know we use that as an indicator. And I mean, I'm too chicken to use it as an indicator because they were built in like 1952. But using the level on it on both axes, it's pretty darn accurate.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, but I'm sure modern ones would be as accurate.
Of course, the advantage of using a 1.5-inch pipe with the cap is that the cap is exactly 2 inches diameter. So it fits nice and snug in the hole, so you really can't move it around.
Unless you drilled your hole crooked.
Yeah, unless I drilled a hole crooked. Sure.
I told you the story about when I put my fence in, and me and a buddy had one of those gas-powered 2-inch augers. And we have our soil out here is like this caliche stuff that the guy at this hardware store told me, well, you know that the 2000 PSI El Cheapo bag concrete, the soil here is stronger than that. As long as it's dry. When it gets wet, it turns to mush, but as long as it's dry, it's stronger than the concrete. So we get out there with the post hole digger, and that sucker screwed itself into the ground, and we could not get it out of the ground.
And you were going around with it, huh?
We kept it from going around, but we could not. The idea is you're supposed to hold it so that it augers the dirt out. But
instead,
we didn't know that. So we just kind of kept it from going around, and it screwed itself right into the ground, and we could not get it out of the ground. We did eventually, but it was a pain in the neck. And then we learned how to use it, but it was I wish I had somebody videoing it because I could put it up on YouTube as one of those.
This is how not to do it.
Yeah, hold my beer and watch this, you know, one of those.
Well, I actually hurt my shoulder with just the, electric drill and the garden auger. And I hit a rock and it wanted to take me.
Yes.
It thought I was the less.
Your drill has good torque then.
I bought one just for this purpose. It was a perfect excuse to get myself a new,
nice.
Contractor type drill.
And Dave, I bought a Ryobi 1/2-inch also as an excuse. And the fortunate thing about that, it has an extension handle on one side, so you can actually have a two-handed grip.
Oh.
I still twisted my arms a couple of times, but it was a lot easier.
Well, at least I'm not alone.
My Bosch impact drill has a side handle too, and you can set it to non-impact. So that'll be one to use for drilling because I'll wait till it's moist out here though.
That might help with the
water in the ground.
Might help with the limestone I got.
Yeah. I know.
Well, gentlemen, I'm going to say 7-3. It's getting late. So,
yeah.
Okay.
Excellent conversation. I learned a lot tonight and I'm excited. So, everybody stay healthy.
7-3, everyone.
Yep.
7-3. Take
care. Good night, folks.
Bye-bye.